Chapter 17. Code Red.
Good evening, Vicar. And you must be Alex, what? It's a little cold in here. I'm afraid I couldn't get the heaters to work. Would you like a cup of tea? I've made a pot.
Alex looks around the darkened warehouse. It's not totally pitch black. A couple of underpowered bulbs glimmer in the twilight, dangling on wires from the crossbeams. There's enough light to see rows of shelving receding into the distance, rising to just below the ceiling, stacked with boxes and tubes and piles of paper on pallets. There are some work tables at the front of the space, and behind them, stacks of enormous billboard-sized posters. The old man gestures at a teapot, surrounded by a neat cluster of mugs and an open half-pint carton of milk. His loose-skinned hand shakes quite noticeably as he picks up the teapot and begins to pour.
I come out here quite regularly. I find that creature comforts always make it slightly more bearable. Don't you agree?
Alex nods, unable to break the sudden conviction that this is all a horrible dream.
Yes, that's certainly true,
says Pete. To Alex's surprise, he seems to have relaxed somewhat.
We've met, haven't we? In, archives. You're Basil. I'm sorry, Bob didn't introduce us properly. No, that's quite all right, says the ancient archivist. How do you take your tea? Milk and sugar?
Milk, no sugar, says Pete.
He nudges Alex.
Oh, no milk, one sugar.
Alex looks at the door they entered through, then back at the elderly Basil. Woman with gun, or elderly man with teapot? Nostrils flare.
You're a vampire,
he exclaims, then bites his tongue.
Don't be silly. Vampires don't exist.
Basil retorts, then sniffs. He finishes pouring the tea.
Unless we're talking about the sanguinary curse that adheres to inanimate objects, of course. The organization has several of those in inventory. But that's another story. I could have said it takes one to know one. But then we would be tacitly admitting that vampires do exist. And then we'd have to do what vampires always do when they meet.
His hands shake, Alex notices, but his voice is steady and his speech is clear and unhesitating.
What would vampires do when they meet?
Asks Alex.
You've seen Highlander. There can be only one.
An expression, hard to read in the twilight, crosses Basil's face.
No? You haven't seen Highlander? I must confess the talkies are my one vice. I picked it up in the early 1920s and can't seem to shake it. Vampires kill, lad. It's in their nature. They can't help it. If they don't kill, they die horribly. It is common law among their kind that the public, were they aware of vampires, would mandate naked noonday parades and shoot everyone who didn't turn up. Or something like that. So a vampire who allows himself to be recognized as such is a clear and present danger to all other vampires. More tea, Vicar.
Alex stares at Basil. The gears in his head are whirring as they mesh at high speed, building a Babbage engine picture of a proposition in predicate calculus.
Why are you breaking the rules?
He finally asks, taking the mug. A wry smile creeps across Basil's face.
If you don't need me, I'll just be leaving,
Pete suggests, sidling sideways towards the door. Evidently, he's decided that he'd rather take his chances with the serial killer outside.
No, I think you should stay,
Basil says, affably enough, and Pete lurches to a stop, as if his feet are rooted to the stained concrete floor.
We don't always kill each other. If we're evenly matched, we may even leave one another alone. There's no victor in a fight where everybody dies. To each his territory. I'm not the only ancient in London, Alex, or even the strongest. But that's a long story. If I arranged for you to be made, why do you think I would kill you?
But the woman outside. But Evan's dead.
Evan was your colleague, wasn't he? The, hipster?
Alex nods.
He went hunting, Basil explains. If he hadn't gone hunting, he'd still be alive.
Hunting for...
Hunting for a blood meal, because he was hungry.
Can you feel the hunger, Alex?
Can you feel it eating you?
Alex nods convulsively.
I've been reading up on you, you know. Almost everyone's file ends up in the archives eventually. I read your Miss Murphy's folder years ago, and the reports on her progress. Saw she'd make an excellent client. If I ever need to dispose of her, I can shut her down with a single anonymous phone call. Mr. Menendez is, shall we say, surplus to requirements, and I have arranged for him to be let go as part of the downsizing. He's another solitary hunter. We can't permit that. The others, you, for instance, are promising. If you can follow instructions to the letter, we can work together. I can feed you, you know, safely. It has been a long time since I have had slaves, but I think a Praetorian bodyguard of vampires will suit me nicely during the troubled times to come. Case Nightmare Green and all that. Drink your tea, lad. It's getting cold. But...
Alex looks at Pete. The vicar is clearly frightened, and is making the most peculiar hunching, crouching motions. After a few seconds, Alex realizes that Pete really does think his feet are glued to the floor. It's as if he's stuck in a tar pit.
"Why am I here?" he finally asks. "If you didn't bring me here to kill me."
He blinks.
"You were in on the senior auditor's meeting, on the inside of his scheme to unearth the vampire in the laundry."
Basil nods and puts his mug down. Alex reads the logo and message on its side. Magic Circle of Safety.
It was inevitable that sooner or later somebody would notice. I could feel the questions beginning, the scepticism slipping. Once everyone moved out of Dancy House, it was only a matter of time before the gesh I worked into the very stones began to lose its grip on their minds. So I planned for this contingency. There will be a small downsizing in an obscure government department, and the individuals who are most credulous and inclined to believe in the existence of vampires will cease to trouble me. At the same time, a particular thorn in my side, the most dangerously psychotic sorcerer in London, who coincidentally created the lady who greeted you, will be drawn out, removed. I've stripped him of his best defences and manoeuvred him into a position where he thinks he has no alternative but to attempt to execute the threat presented by the laundry. I do not expect him to survive. You're in the safest place you could possibly be right now, Alex, drinking tea in this warehouse with an ancient and powerful vampire, while a vampire hunter stands guard on the door. All you have to do is obey me, and you'll be fine.
Basil peers at Alex.
You are thirsty, yes?
Alex nods again. There is something soothing and reassuring about Basil's presence, about the knowledge that Alex is in the presence of an ancient and benevolent elder who wishes him only good. If only the ward he wears on the thong around his neck would stop buzzing like an angry wasp.
"There is lifeblood here," says Basil.
He turns and shuffles slowly towards the far end of the work table. Alex follows him on the other side.
"The Magic Circle of Safety public information posters, such as this one here, show how to create a basic protective ward. They were for distribution to the herd in event of an incursion. However, they are also easily modified with a conductive pencil. Add a simple circuit, and they can be activated, like this one, nearly 6 feet in diameter. The warded zone is cut off from space and time outside, but you can also use it to stop time from passing inside. There are some drawbacks, but if one wants to store something, like a packed lunch to be consumed later."
And indeed, there is a perfect hemisphere of darkness rising from the floor, beside the end of the large table, atop a sheet of heavy paper that flops across the concrete. Its darkness is so complete that in the twilight it is almost invisible. Basil gestures at it.
"I use this warehouse to store my meals. While they're in stasis, the progressive deterioration caused by the parasite is kept in check. I need to take them out of stasis while I'm drinking, so that they can feed the parasite, and the parasite feeds me in turn. But it reduces the frequency with which one needs to kill. Reduces the risk of exposure, too. Would you care for a glass? I have a passable O rhesus negative on tap, stored in this chart."
Alex's stomach rumbles. Then, as if in sympathy, his phone vibrates.
"Give that to me."
Basil holds out his hand. As if in a dream, Alex watches himself hand his phablet over. The old man looks at it in distaste.
"I see," he says. "A primitive ward, without the standard organization back door. How annoying! How does one... Ah!"
Alex's stomach lurches again as Basil removes the back cover and pulls the battery, then tosses the disemboweled phone along the work table.
"No interruptions, if you please. Now attend."
He bends down, then extends a finger towards a tracery of silver script that circles the base of the stasis field, and smudges out a single character. The dome of darkness disappears. In its place, there is a small wooden chair. A young boy, aged perhaps 8, sits in the chair, or rather is strapped to it with duct tape at wrists and thighs and ankles. He's cheaply dressed, in scuffed trainers and sweatpants and a hoodie that don't fit properly, and his head lolls. He doesn't seem to be aware of his environment. The green head end of a cannula pokes from the top of his right hand, held in place by surgical tape. A box of syringes sits beneath the chair.
"He's sedated, but if he could talk, he would tell you that perhaps 80 minutes have passed while he's been sitting on this chair. His mother sold him to me for £200 and an ounce of heroin a couple of years ago. She's dead now, of an overdose. I think I got the better deal."
Basil picks up a 20-milliliter syringe and bends over the boy's wrist. His extraction is fast and practiced.
"Here, drink. The more time he spends out of stasis, the faster he'll deteriorate."
Alex takes the syringe with nerveless fingers. Behind him, across the warehouse, he can hear Pete retching. But it doesn't matter. Nothing matters, next to the thirst that has been eating away at his guts. The ward around his neck has stopped buzzing and lies quiescent against his skin, burning hot. He raises the syringe to his lips and squeezes the plunger, overcome by a sense of desire that is erotic in its intensity, turning his knees to jelly as the first drops touch his tongue. Blackness. Orgasm. Total loss of control. A few seconds pass. Alex realizes he's lying on the floor. He opens his eyes. He's fallen over, but he feels great. For the first time in weeks, he isn't half-starved, on the edge of perpetual mild nausea. Someone is standing over him.
"Alex, this is important. Are you awake? Can you hear me, Alex?"
He tries to nod, then tries to say, "Yes," but what comes out is,
"Oh, wow! Good lad! Stand up!"
Alex rolls over, then pushes himself to his knees.
"You, Vicar, over here. Yes, go to the young boy in the chair. Stand behind him. Bend over, I'm going to reactivate the ward."
Something out of sight changes. Some texture in the background noise, which tells Alex the dome is back in place. And of a sudden, the hunger pangs are back, albeit muted.
"Alex, ah, good. Stand up straight."
He can feel the force of Basil's will wrapped around him like a warm blanket, and he feels so grateful he can barely find words to express himself.
"Stop trying to think, there's a good boy. I want you to go and stand by the door, facing it."
What?
"The door, Alex."
"Damn it, you're half-starved into idiocy."
"That door, the one you came in through, do you remember?"
Alex nods.
"Good. Go and stand by it. If anyone comes through the door, I want you to kill them. It is very important that you kill them."
"Must I?"
"Yes, Alex, you must. Otherwise they will kill you."
"But I've never..."
He shakes.
"Need my phone."
"Never mind your... Wait, your phone? Is there something on it? A weapon?"
Alex nods.
"All right, you may collect your phone. Then go and stand by the door and kill anybody who comes through it."
Alex, full of energy for the first time in days, jumps to obey. Basil Northcote Robinson, stripped of his Coffin Dodger cover story, stands revealed as an ancient and powerful vampire, who has been working his insidious will on the organization for half a century without detection. But Basil is not omniscient. He has forgotten something. In fact, He has forgotten several somethings, the combined effect of which will undermine his fiendish scheme to use the organization to destroy his greatest rival, while using his greatest rival to snuff out everybody in the organization who knows the truth about vampires. For the past century, Basil has lived in England, in the heart of a country riven by two world wars and a grudging retreat from empire. But the retreat from empire ended nearly three decades ago, with the handover of Hong Kong to China. Basil does not, for the most part, deal with young people. He experiences them as most pensioners do, as shadowy presences in menacing hoodies who dart and mock from the pavements and slums, fearful images touched up by Daily Mail headline writers and Telegraph editorials. He experiences them mediated through the distorting lens of the silver screen, the nightly drama of the television news broadcast. He is unmarried and has no living relatives that he is aware of. He does not experience them as the larval form of his co-workers. He was born so long ago that he has forgotten what it was like to be a teenager or a young adult male. Metrosexuality is something he reads about in newspaper op-ed rants, but doesn't actually know. And as for geek culture, most of the young men of Alex's age who Basil has known over the past century had undergone military service. If they haven't carried a gun, they've lived through bombing raids, grew up playing cowboys and Indians, or provos and army, took a keen interest in things martial. Basil is applying these sepia-toned benchmarks of young and virile manhood to Alex, and basing his assumptions of his capabilities upon them. But Alex is a child of the late 1980s, of helicopter parenting and stranger danger, and school rides and the snowdrop campaign and a blanket ban on handguns. Alex is a brilliant mathematician and promising, if embryonic, applied computational demonologist. But Alex is also a geek who suffers from imposter syndrome and hypochondria to boot, and whose knowledge of handguns was acquired from movies, where the stars hold their pistols the wrong way up and obey the laws of Hollywood physics. He is, in short, not exactly the ideal vampire bodyguard. He is also prone to overthinking things. We are delayed in traffic again, which means we are now 12 minutes behind our bellwether. I know the arguments for and against having a brick waiting outside the warehouse. Let's just say the argument against won. If there's one thing worse than going up against an ancient and powerful vampire sorcerer with mind control skills, it's going up against an ancient and powerful vampire sorcerer with mind control skills who has noticed you and taken over your 8-man squad of elite special forces soldiers before you arrive.
Orders, Mr. Howard.
I rub my forehead. Wait one. I call up the police CCTV operations room again. They've got a constable monitoring the cameras around the warehouse in real time. No change notified. One car arrived 90 minutes ago. A woman got out and went inside. Hasn't left. Then our decoys arrived 9 minutes ago and went inside. Monitoring commenced 3 hours ago. Nothing before then, although presumably the security guard showed up for work this morning. So we're looking at 4 souls inside. Security chap, unidentified female, hour two. I pause. My working assumption is the female is hostile until proven otherwise. She may be a fang, or she may be a lamplighter for the adversary. We're all warded, but you should not assume that your wards will work normally around the adversary. Treat with extreme caution. Put her down if she presents a threat. I pause again. Scary, do you prefer to go in through the front door or use the loading dock and the fire exits? You have tactical control. My ward vibrates briefly, then stops. I glance down at my smartphone and see the particular app it's running. Burning Goat Skull. Don't ask. It's part of our special occult countermeasures suite. Alex's ward just overloaded and fried. We have contact.
Team Alpha, Plan 2,
announces Scary. That's the fire exit.
Team Bravo, Plan 3.
That's the loading bay. I feel the truck lean forward on its suspension and sway as it takes a bend, then bounce twice very hard on speed pillows.
We're going to park in front of the office door, on top of the bike and the car. Stand by for a bumpy landing. Action in 30 seconds.
There's a click in my headphones.
Mr. Howard,
if you'd please stay behind us this time.
Thank you, Sergeant. Your advice is noted.
I grit my teeth and close my eyes, forcing my inner eye to open. I can see surprisingly well this way, although what I see is nothing very nice. I have nightmares about using this talent.
You'll need me to handle the adversary, once you've cleared the way.
Yes, sir.
A hand pats me on the shoulder. Then there's a violent crunching sound, and I'm hurled against my seatbelt. Poor bloody Pete. If he gets out of this alive, he's going to have one hell of an insurance claim form to fill out. I'll have to see if I can get the SA to sign off on buying him a replacement scooter, citing necessity. I pull off my headphones and yank on my helmet in the moment of silence that follows. A gust of cold air hits me in the face as the doors slam. I pull my visor down, release my seatbelt, and wait 10 seconds as the heavies bail out. Then I follow them through the nearest exit, opposite the entrance to the office. So I'm standing right behind Sergeant Howe when the door explodes. That's why I survive. I register it as a bright flash and a simultaneous ringing in my ears. Then I realize I'm lying on my back, looking up at the side of the Oculus truck.
What happened?
I wonder as I flail around and try to sit up, then slip on something warm and moist. I can smell shit. Something buzzes in my ears, and then my ward goes off like a hive of bees. I can't hear properly. I roll to my knees and realize numbly I'm rolling in what's left of Steve, which means enemy action. So I keep rolling and roll under the Oculus truck as I reach for my pistol and realize I can't find the holster, and my bad right arm is stinging like crazy, so I open my inner eye fully and the confusion and darkness light up. I will note that Steve Howe wasn't visible from the office window and wasn't yet trying to open the door. It just went bang. Walls dissolve. There's a smoking hole in the front of the warehouse, and a body inside, and another body, live, with a gun, and there's an unhealthy bluish sheen to it like an oil slick or toxic waste or something. I hear faint shouts, the harsh metallic crack of gunfire. There are more people standing farther inside the building, but the one in the office is advancing and raising a pistol. I grunt and reach out for them with imaginary fangs and claws. I'm about 5 meters away, but I've done this before, through a door even. I can feel their mind squirming like a toad, and there's something sick about it. It tastes foul. No, she tastes foul. I bite and bite and chew and spit, and then I find myself wishing for a psychic glass of water. The trouble with this Eater of Souls talent, or curse, or what have you, is that there are some people whose souls you'd want to scrape off the underside of your shoe if you trod in them, and you really don't want them giving you gastric symptoms. I rewind her rage and her joy as the door blows, taking down the first attacker, and catch an echo of earlier memories. The memory of sex. The memory of her white lightning orgasm as she broke Evan's neck while sitting astride his lap, in a moment of total exultant control over everything she hated. I squeal and try to shove her out of my head, but it's too late, because she's lying halfway through the doorway with bloody tears trickling from her eyes. I killed her, and I'm going to have to live with that. I retch at the overpowering stench of blood and shit and worm my way out from under the truck. My hearing is all fuzzed from the explosion and the gunfire, which has died down. I've got a job to do, damn it. The fire is suppressive, to convince the people holed up inside to stay down. That's the plan, anyway. What were Steve and I meant to do in the office? Oh, that. I kneel, then stagger to my feet and lurch forward, slip sliding on a loop of intestines, until I catch my balance and crunch down on the dead woman's ribcage. There's another dead body behind the desk, wearing a security guard's uniform. He's been dead for some time, going by the way he's dark to my vision. I briefly consider raising him and using him as a proxy, but it'd take too long to summon a feeder. There's a fuse box on the wall beside the inner door, the one that leads to the archive. I open it and look for the circuit breaker I helped the electrician connect this morning. It's still open. Flick. Inside the archive, the string of ultraviolet lights we laid along the top of the storage racks this morning blink on. And then the screaming starts. The rest of the mop-up operation goes smoothly enough, modulo the mopping up, which is disturbing. The screaming from inside the warehouse is continuous, high-pitched, and terrible. It's the kind of sound you associate with cats being skinned alive, or slasher movies, or medieval torture fests. I open the door. Alex is moaning with fear, not screaming. He lies curled in a ball on the floor beside the doorway, hoodie pulled up, hands and face tucked in. Clever boy. His ward's toast, so I have to assume he's been turned, but right now he's focused on keeping his hands and face out of the light that burns. He's smoking, but the duck and cover drill, combined with his hoodie, seems to have saved him from going the full Barbie. There's the characteristic black dome of a powered-up ward at one side of the warehouse. Later. There is one other body in here, exposed to the eldritch purple glow of the booby-trap lights. It is making a hoarse screeching sound, almost a tea-kettle whistle. Its spine is curled over, and its jaw gapes wide, and there is smoke pouring out of it, with pale fire flickering in its eye sockets and burning within its ribcage, where it is visible through the clothing that has scorched away. I can see the pallor of bone through the tattered charcoal of his trousers. A bell is ringing, and after a while I realize it's the fire alarm. Our friend must have tripped the smoke detector. The worst thing about it all is that he's still alive and screaming. Observe, orient, decide, act. I touch the press-to-talk mic attached to my helmet. Hope it still works. Bob here. How is down? Repeat, how is down? Unidentified female Oppo is down. I'm in the back, lights on. Repeat, lights on. Alex is neutral. I can't see Pete. Unidentified Oppo is on fire but undead. I need hands here. About a quarter of a ton of heavily armed Spec Ops soldiers tackle me onto the floor, forming a rugby scrum with me as the ball. Then my earpiece crackles.
Awaiting orders, sir.
Silly me. I guess I got in front of them again.
Get a tarp over Alex and get him into the front office, handcuffs and sedation. Assume he's been turned. Find the vicar. That dome, point your guns at it. If it collapses and anything comes out of it, shoot them. Then get off me.
The weight eases momentarily.
Yes, sir.
I've got tinnitus, damn it. I feel a momentary pang. I can still smell the contents of Steve Howe's guts all over me. Taste that awful woman's weird craving for sex with paralyzed vampires. Someone made her that way, surely? I shove the thoughts aside for later.
What about...
I stand up. So does the burning man.
Freeze!
Hisses the burning man. We all freeze. Our wards simultaneously buzz violently, then give up the ghost and start to smoke.
Mr. Howard.
Bits of carbonized cloth and flesh drip from his bones as he straightens up and turns to face us, like a walking skeleton, with pale red worms writhing in the back of his skull. He's not hissing just because of the flames. There's something wrong with his dentition.
We meet again.
Name, rank, and number? I ask.
Don't you recognize me, what?
Skeletal jaws grin, and now I realize I'm hearing his voice inside my head. He doesn't have lungs or larynx with which to laugh.
I really must thank you. I do appreciate a warm welcome. It affirms my sense of self-worth.
The blood-sucking Terminator impersonator steps around the table.
One of you fine, upstanding chappies, yes, you, is going to go back there and turn out the bloody lights. Wait. Before you go, give me your gun.
The soldier he's pointing at jerkily unslings his MP5 and extends it, butt first, towards Basil. That's when I realize how terribly pear-shaped this op has gone.
You've had your little jape, ha ha. In case you were wondering, we get harder to kill as we get older. This confirms something I've suspected for a decade or two, but lacked the inclination to idly test. Mind over matter and all that. It'll be fun to go out in daylight again when all this is over. Now go and stand over there, in that corner. You've been very naughty boys.
I stumble along with the other three heavies. I am ashamed to say I'm shaking. Unlike them, I'm faking obedience. His will to obey is amazingly powerful, but so is my will to resist. On the other hand, he's pointing a submachine gun at us, and I need a few seconds to think. What's worse than an elderly vampire? Answer: an elderly vampire with a submachine gun and sunburn-induced bad attitude. He's clearly a whole lot more powerful than the run-of-the-mill newbie fangs I've been dealing with up to now. And unless my middle names aren't Oliver Francis, I'm only going to get one chance to lay Basil the self-propelled barbecue to rest. While my back is half turned to him, I cross myself, banker style. Spectacles, testicles, wallet, and camera? Ah, camera. I pull the battered little Fuji 3D camera out and flick the power button. Mary's lot didn't break it, even though it's a bit scratched and beaten up. I'm going to assume it's still loaded with the Basilisk firmware, rather than the normal happy-snappy variety, because if I'm wrong, I'm going to die in the next few seconds. I'll just have to trust my lack of any memory of having swapped out the memory card for the one with a regular boot image.
"You're going to wait in that corner until I receive a phone call from the new annex,"
explains our chatty death about town.
"There's a bit of mopping up going on there right now. But once it's over, we can all get in your truck and go home."
Mopping up? That doesn't sound right, I think fuzzily, stealing a surreptitious glance at the camera back. Have we just been mousetrapped? Yes, it's showing the gunsight display, not the camera focus graticule.
"And then, yes, most of you can just forget you ever saw me."
The ultraviolet lights go out, and there is an immediate blood-curdling scream from the front office.
What?
Says Basil, turning and raising his gun. There is this thing about mathematicians and programmers. They come in several flavors, often overlapping, but with distinct strengths and weaknesses specific to each type. Alex's talents are multivariate and recondite, but he has a particular aptitude for language lawyering. That is, he takes great delight in exploring the nooks and crannies of formal languages and understanding how and in what circumstances they exhibit side effects or anomalous behavior that a naive or inexperienced programmer would not expect. Alex is also very intelligent. He is under Basil's control, but he is not happy about his long-term survival prospects if this situation persists, especially as his entire face is on fire, and it feels as if his nose will fall off if he sneezes. Basil is not, in Alex's estimate, an entirely thoughtful employer. Certainly he is unlikely to prove as accommodating or merciful as the laundry's HR department. Alex cannot disobey Basil's direct order, but he can creatively interpret the instructions he has already been given, and he cannot help but overhear what Basil is saying next door. And it occurs to him that when Basil said, "Stand by the door and kill anybody who comes through it," Basil didn't specify which direction they had to be going in. In the normal state of affairs, a fight between a highly trained soldier from the territorial SAS and a pencil-necked geek will tend to end with a de-leaded geek. But in the interests of rebalancing the equation, the highly trained soldier has just handed his principal weapon to the vampire overlord, who has turned him into a shambling robot whose motivation is the overriding order to turn out the bloody lights rather than defending himself. And the pencil-necked geek is a fully juiced-up young vampire who has rules-lawyered himself around to some very interesting conclusions about his own freedom of action within the constraints Basil specified, and who is extremely pissed off right now because he has third-degree burns across most of his face. Alex isn't stupid. He lets the soldier pull the circuit breaker, and then he tries to kill him. I don't remember the next bit too clearly. The light flickered, and something of its quality changed. It reddened, or lost something from the blue end of the spectrum. There was a scream, and the nightmare figure turned towards the doorway and raised its gun. That's when I began to turn, and raised my camera, and pushed the shutter release immediately. Not even aiming at him, just relying on the firmware to lock onto the person-shaped object closest to the center of the focal area and do the rest. I suspect I was in shock at this point, because my memory of the camera is that it felt as if it was made of solid tungsten, and my knees were shaking, and my vision was blurred and I could barely focus on the screen, and I felt sick and hot and cold simultaneously. But that's nothing compared to how Basil felt when I took his picture. What happens when you point a basilisk gun at a semi-skeletonized vampire elder? Basil sparkles electric blue for just a moment. There's a loud bang. A fragment of skull whizzes past my ear. And then the pile of red-hot bones collapses across the floor, as does the submachine gun they were holding a fraction of a second ago. Thankfully, there is no accidental discharge. One of the hot pieces of bone lands on the edge of the warded bubble and begins to burn a hole in the paper, scorching the letters and linkages away. The bubble flickers and vanishes, revealing an apprehensive-looking vicar contorted over a chair holding a child. Thankfully, Basil's instructions to Scary's men have overridden my orders to shoot anything that comes out of the bubble. A voice calls from the office.
Is Basil dead? Can I stop killing this guy yet?
What?
Yes, stop! I shout.
On second thoughts, Alex, I want you to lie down with your hands behind your back, wrists together. I realize I'm still pointing my deadly little camera at the opposite wall and force myself to lower it. I turn and see the soldiers turning away from the wall, shaking themselves and focusing. Go and restrain him in case Sparkle Boy here implanted any post-mortem commands, I tell them. He'll need burn support. I'm going to sort out the vicar. I'm shaking and shivery, but I know what needs to be done. Pete is straightening up and saying something about untying the kid, about V syndrome and needing to get him to a hospital. I blink. Feel the shuddering sense of exultation that woman would have taken at the moment Basil's skull exploded, almost enough to give her a spontaneous orgasm. She hated him and lusted for him at the same time. And I bend over and spit on the floor, because I can taste blood on my lips. I'm soaking in the stuff, actually. I nearly throw up. It's Steve Howes. Poor bloody Steve. It's scant consolation knowing that if I'd gotten in front of him, I'd have taken the vampire hunter's booby trap right in the face. I stumble and go over on one ankle as I walk towards Pete. He's saying something else now, something urgent. Something about Basil storing his prey in the Magic Circle of Safety archive. I shake my head. Something is coming into focus. Something huge and nasty and vile. Who added reviving Magic Circle of Safety to the Training Wheels project list, I wonder? As if I can't guess. More importantly, why did Basil do it? We've got to get back to the new annex, I say. Then I remember I've got a phone. Wait. I pull it out, but iPhones don't work too well when they've been sprayed with blood and rolled around on. Shit. I turn and stumble towards the front office. Past the guys who are apologizing to Alex as they apply the handcuffs and leg restraints, ignore that woman, shuffle past the dead security guard who is staring unblinking at the ceiling with gunshot wound eyes, and see his phone on the desk. I lean over the corpse and dial a number from memory, finger shaking so badly that I have to stop and start over twice before I get it right. It's picked up on the second ring.
Operations.
Howard here.
Transferring you now.
They've been pre-briefed. 2 seconds later, I hear a familiar voice.
Speak, boy.
It's Angleton. He sounds distracted. I dry swallow, trying to ignore the taste in my mouth. Code Red, I manage. We don't use Code Red very often. In fact, I've never heard of it being used before. Code Blue means there's an off-site emergency, probably hostile action on our soil. Code Red means there's an on-site hostile action, like the attack I expect Basil to have arranged to take out everyone who might suspect his existence.
You're a bit late, Angleton says laconically.
I hear banging in the background.
We'll talk later, he adds.
Then the line goes dead.